Welcome to the Time We Have podcast, presented to you by Motor Neuron Disease, New South Wales. MND New South Wales acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land we live on. We pay our respects to all elders, past and present, of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations.
I'm also really grateful to the speechies who mentored me and shared all their tips and tricks. But I would say my greatest teachers were the people with MND themselves and their families.
Hello and a very warm welcome to the MND New South Wales podcast, The Time We Have. My name is Sabine Krajewski, and I have the pleasure to speak with Sarah Elvash today. Sarah completed her Bachelor of Applied Science majoring in speech pathology with honours in 2017. And on her way out, she collected the University Medal, the Dean Scholar Award, and the Speech Pathology Australia Award for Best Graduating Student. From 2019, she worked on her PhD thesis, Uncovering Communication Changes in MS, Understanding the Patient Experience and a Way Forward, which she completed in 2022. Good afternoon, Sarah.
Hi, Sabine. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, me too. So we decided to meet after work to have peace and quiet for the podcast. Where are you? Are you at home?
Yes, I'm at home in my bedroom.
In peace and quiet.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Okay. I would like to get to know you a little bit, of course. So you already told me that you were born in Kuwait, but you have Egyptian background. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
You talk to that a little bit, like how do you get to born in Kuwait when you're Egyptian?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I was born in Kuwait, but my parents, they're both Egyptian, so they were working in Kuwait at the time I was born. And sometimes people haven't actually heard about Kuwait, so it's a very small country in the Middle East in the Gulf, and they speak Arabic. It's very famous for its oil reserves, and it's made up mostly desert, lots of desert, and it's actually one of the countries with the highest temperatures. So growing up, there were some very hot days. So we spent a lot of time in the pool. And growing up, we were very fortunate to be able to visit Egypt quite regularly during the school holidays to see our extended family. And still today, we go back quite regularly since we've moved to Australia. And I really love visiting Egypt. It's a very vibrant country. There's so much history and amazing beaches and lots of incredible food. And actually, one of my favorite memories of Egypt is snorkeling in the Red Sea with all the colorful corals and the fish and the crystal clear waters. Yeah, it's stunning. And growing up in Kuwait, my brother and I, we both went to a British school. And that really helped with the transition to Australia. So my dad had a good opportunity to work in Australia. So we moved when I was around end of primary school. There were definitely challenges with moving and traveling a lot and living in different countries, but I think these experiences were really enriching and have really helped me have a big world view, and they've really helped me to adapt to lots of change. So I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting, and I think it is culturally very different to move to Australia. So even though you speak English and spoke English there, if you went to a British school, but still a lot of differences. Even the climate. I mean, we always say Australia is hot, but I guess compared to Kuwait, not really, right?
A different level. I think I looked up the temperature today and it's 44 degrees there.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. I know you spend a lot of time inside when you're in the Emirates or in Kuwait and you also moved around a little yourself, right? So from Kuwait to Egypt to Australia.
Yeah. That's
and right. Then within Australia, you moved a bit.
Yeah. So we initially, when we came to Australia, we lived in Wagga Wagga for a couple of years. And
that's
then
right, Wagga Wagga, a very foreign place.
And then we moved to Sydney. So some rural life and then some city life. Yeah. And they were both great, different experiences. But now I would call Sydney home.
You call Sydney home, and actually you live in Strathfield with your family, right? And you have quite a few hobbies, you told me. So photography, but also you love the outdoors and are very active out. What other things do you do in your spare time?
Yeah, so outside of work, I love to do lots of different things. And yeah, I find they really help me to feel refreshed and energized when I'm at work. So I really love being creative. So like you said, I love photography, especially taking photos of landscapes and nature. I also really enjoy graphic design. And I just recently got a new sewing machine, so I'm looking forward to sewing again. And I really love nature and being in the great outdoors. I love going on a good adventure. So I love hiking. I love bike riding, especially mountain bike riding. I love the thrill that that gives and exploring different trails. I love sport. So I play a lot of badminton. I enjoy going to the gym with my friends. And I'm a really big tennis fan. So I religiously watch and follow the tennis. And I love to read and watch movies. So I really like listening to people's stories. So I especially enjoy reading biographies and watching movies based on true stories. Lots of things that keep me busy and enrich my life.
Sounds like you have a lot of spare time if you can do all of that.
I wish there was more.
Definitely proof. Were you also able to do some photography in Kuwait or in landscapes in different countries, or is it mainly in Australia where you do photography?
Yeah, so I picked up my interest and hobby in photography in high school when we did it as an elective. So I wasn't into photography when I was younger in Kuwait. But now
I thought when you're going back or so that you would take that opportunity.
Yeah, so definitely when we visit Egypt now, I do take my camera along, and so many amazing opportunities to take photos of big landscapes and deserts and different cultures.
Cool. You did tell me a little bit about what you wanted to be when you grew up, and that was actually very different from what you've become. So you said you wanted to be a pilot because you were fascinated with planes and airports, but you became a speech pathologist. So how did that happen? It's very different.
Yeah, so I would say I accidentally fell into my career, but it was meant to be. So growing up, like you said, my dream was to be a pilot. I really loved all the travel that we did growing up, and I was absolutely fascinated by aeroplanes, and I really enjoyed being in the airport. And I even had the opportunity to go to the Qantas headquarters and sit in the flight simulators. But that's obviously not how things turned out.
Not yet anyway.
Not yet. Maybe a career change down the track. So I grew up in a very medical family. And so I heard a lot about health and different diseases growing up. And that definitely sparked my interest in science, particularly the human body and especially the brain. So I have an older brother. So he's a few years older than me, and he works as a neurologist. And so his interest in the brain really rubbed off on me. So when I finished school and was faced with the reality of choosing my university degree for my career, I decided I can continue to enjoy aeroplanes and the airport by continuing to travel, and that I wanted to do something in health and to help people. So I initially actually thought about being a nurse, but then I spoke to my careers counselor in high school, and she was very helpful. So she knew my interests and my personality, and she was the one that actually suggested Allied Health. And I told her that I knew about physiotherapy, but I didn't think it was the right thing for me because I was always injured from sport. So I felt like I wouldn't be strong enough, but now I'm aware there's lots of different types of physio, and some are much less physical than others. But so the careers counselor was the one who suggested I consider speech pathology. And at that point in time, I don't think I really knew much about what it's like to be a speech pathologist. But I was able to organize an opportunity to actually observe a speech pathologist working, and she was working with children. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't particularly enjoy it, but I somehow still decided to put speech pathology as my preference in university. And I'm
just
so glad.
Think of anything else to do.
And I'm so glad I did, because I absolutely love working as a speechy, and I don't think I can imagine myself doing something different at the moment.
So what does a speechy actually do? I know they're different fields, but from your personal experience, what do you do?
So as a speech pathologist, we can help people in two main areas. So we can assess and diagnose and treat people with swallowing problems and communication problems. So this can include difficulties with eating and drinking, or issues with saliva, like dry mouth or excessive saliva. And in terms of communication, this can include helping people with difficulties with speaking, voice or stuttering, or difficulties using and understanding language, as well as difficulties with reading and writing and social communication. So there's lots of different areas that we can support people with. And often the overarching goal of speech pathology is to promote a person's independence and safety, as well as their quality of life and comfort for as long as possible, especially for the elderly. And we can also
you work mainly with elderly people, right? So you work as a community speech pathologist, and I think your clients, you said, are all 65 and over. And is that because older people are more likely to develop diseases where they need a speech pathologist, or is that your choice to specialize?
That's a good question. I work as a community speech pathologist in a multidisciplinary team, and we work specifically for aged care. So, and we see people 65 and over in their house. So in terms of our role as speech pathologists, we definitely have a role in aged health. So we know communication and swallowing difficulties, they can happen at any stage of life. However, diseases like stroke or cancer or progressive neurological diseases like Parkinson's or dementia or even motor neuron disease, for example, they're more common as people older, so that can affect someone's communication and swallowing, and so we definitely have a role to be able to support clients to improve or learn to manage their symptoms as best as possible. And I really love working in aged care. I really love being able to help people in their older lives live well, and to really advocate for them to receive the right support and information to improve their health and quality of life, because they can often get overlooked.
Yeah, definitely. Great. And you just mentioned working in multidisciplinary teams, right? So what other allied health professionals do you work most closely with in your capacity as a speechies?
Yeah. So one of my favorite things about my work and my role, and especially when working with people with MND, is that we do get to collaborate with the rest of the multidisciplinary team. And you're constantly learning from each other by working closely and problem solving. It allows you to provide that really holistic care, which the patients themselves and the families really appreciate. So in my role specifically, I work quite closely with occupational therapists. So especially when working with people with MND, we collaborate when the person's hand function has often changed, especially when looking up setting up a communication device. So seeing how we can help the person with MND access that device as best as possible. I also work closely with dietitians, especially around swallowing and nutrition and hydration. So we might do joint sessions together, especially if we're giving education around alternative methods of eating and drinking, like tube feeding. And I also sometimes work with the physiotherapists, and in terms of, you know, people with MND that would look at positioning, or if they're going to prescribe a neck collar, we can look at how that neck collar might affect someone's swallowing and saliva, and just making sure that they're as safe as possible. Also, we work with the respiratory physio and that's to help us understand the person's respiratory function. And outside the allied health team, we work quite closely with the medical team. So we might work with the palliative care doctors or the rehab doctors for different reasons, like if we're looking at how to help with someone's saliva and we need pharmacological interventions, or if we're discussing alternative feeding methods, whether someone is appropriate for tube feeding. We'd have those discussions as a team.
Sounds ideal, because depending on where you are, patients don't always have a large multidisciplinary team, right? And then you probably have to also take over from, you know, things that maybe another allied health professional would usually do. So it sort of overlaps, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. And I am really grateful that we do work in a multidisciplinary team, but I have worked in other places where you don't have that team, and it does make it challenging.
I mentioned in the beginning that your thesis was about communication in people with MS, but now you're talking that you're working a lot with people who have MND. What's MND specific for you as a speechy?
Yeah, so in terms of MND, we know that it can affect swallowing muscles as well as our speech and voice muscles. And generally, as a speech pathologist, we have a toolkit with lots of different tools in our toolbox, and we might pull out different tools depending on the person we see. And for example, if someone had a stroke, the focus might be improving lost function, such as improving their language problems through intensive language exercises. Whilst for someone with MND, the focus is a little bit different. So MND is a progressive neurological disease. So the focus is often on planning and preparing for possible future change. So for example, we might do something like voice banking. We've got our toolbox. It's got lots of different tools, and we decide which tool to take out depending on the person's, lots of different factors. So depending on the person's strengths, their areas of difficulty, what their specific goals are, and all in the context of the specific condition. So if it's MND, we think about the future, and there's lots of planning, and based on that, we tailor our intervention.
I like the toolbox idea. It does make sense to have different tools for different types of diseases or difficulties with speech and swallowing in particular. You just mentioned voice banking, and this was actually when our first topic, when we first got in touch, right? It was about a voice banking project, and you're quite interested in and passionate about voice banking. Can you just in very simple terms explain what that is and how voice banking works?
Voice banking is definitely an area that I'm really interested in. So generally, and simply put, it's a process that allows a person to create their personal synthetic voice. And it's an approximation of their natural voice. So the process involves making audio recordings of a list of phrases, and the recordings are then sent to a company, which then creates a synthetic voice. And that voice can then be uploaded onto a communication device, and every time the person types a novel message, it's spoken in the person's synthetic voice. And there's lots of reasons why someone might choose to voice bank. So for example, it might be to preserve a part of their personality or their sense of identity, or it might be to maintain a sense of social and emotional connectedness through their voice with their family, or it might be to fight back and to have some control over this disease. But it's also important to think about the other side and to think about why people might choose to not voice bank. So for example, this might be because they feel like it doesn't preserve their identity, and the way we preserve our identity is very, very individual, and it differs from person to person. They might also dislike the quality of the synthetic voice when it's modeled to them. So I will always play to a client my own voice banking. And so far, voice banking voices, they don't convey emotion or intonation. But I think it will be really interesting to see if this is going to change as technology changes. And, you know, some people are just happy with the generic voices that are available on the devices, and they might just have a preference to spend their time and energy.
So that would be like a Stephen Hawking's voice that is just a generated voice that has nothing to do with his original voice.
Yeah, so some generic voices come with the tablets, and you can just choose them.
But if it's your own, of course, it wouldn't convey emotion because you have to repeat bits and pieces and certain words over and over again, and the emotion wouldn't be in there. That makes sense. So I'm just thinking of clients or, you know, people you look after. It could be quite tricky to suggest to them to do voice banking, right? Because you look into the future and you go like, well, you will lose your voice at some point, and maybe you should think about it now. So how do you do that? What's a good time to suggest voice banking or to discuss it with somebody, for example, with MND?
Yeah, so voice banking is best done before a person experiences changes to their speech. So I recommend if someone is interested in voice banking to do it soon after the diagnosis. And the aim is that getting in early helps capture a person's natural voice quality, speech rate, and helps ensure that their speech is still really clear. But
can you really suggest it you know, shortly after somebody's diagnosed? Because that's exactly my question, because how do you do that if somebody has to figure out what that means and live with the diagnosis and get used to it, and you come with voice banking and saying, you know, this is going to happen somewhere down the road and it's good to do that now. You know, that's, isn't that a bit tricky?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. It's definitely a really challenging conversation to have, and it can be very confronting for the person.
Yeah.
You know, talking about future loss, it can be very emotional and overwhelming. And as speech pathologists, we're not trained counselors, but we often find ourselves in situations and we are incidental counselors.
Definitely.
And during these conversations about voice banking, it's not going to be easy. And it's so important to acknowledge the person's emotions and to hold that space for them and their feelings of grief and shock and uncertainty. Yeah. And sometimes people with MND, they might express that they feel like they're giving up by accepting a treatment option, especially early on, like voice banking. So one way I like to explain voice banking is that it's like insurance. So for example, you take out home insurance for possible future damage or loss, like theft or a fire, but you don't know for certain if it will happen. So voice banking can be thought of as vocal insurance. So you do it now and you can draw upon it in the future if it's needed in case of future speech change. And the great thing about voice banking is that you don't have to pay to create an online account or to do the recording. So you only pay when and if you buy the voice. So there are...
But don't you need the software to do it?
Yeah. So the software is online.
And
there's different voice banking softwares. And if you are someone who is living with MND and you are interested in voice banking, I would encourage you to speak to your speech pathologist. And if you don't have a speech pathologist, you could talk to your MND advisor and they could link you in with one and they can guide you through that process and give you information.
Yeah. So if you have a patient with bulbar onset, so the first sign and symptom is maybe that the speech is becoming a bit slurred and so on, can they still do voice banking or is that maybe problematic?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think, that's definitely one of the challenges that I face working with people with MND is that they're actually often referred to me later in their disease. And that means that they come when their speech has already changed. So it really depends on how much it has changed. And there are still options for voice preservation that can be explored if someone is referred later to speech pathology after their speech has already changed. For example, there's voice repair softwares, or a person can use a donor voice. So maybe family can do the voice banking if they sound similar, or they can use old recordings of their voice if they have any. But these options have their limitations. They're often much more expensive and the result is often not as good. But they're definitely still worth exploring if the person is interested. And there's also the option of message banking, which is not creating a whole synthetic voice, but just recording small short phrases that are really meaningful and can be played back exactly as they're recorded.
That's good to know. We talked about how technology can be used in good ways, and what you're describing right now is of course very helpful for people who are considering voice banking, but it can also be maybe used in bad ways. So how important is it for people to know that and to express early on what to do with their voice and what not to? Because theoretically you could use that voice for all sorts of things. I don't know. Sort of the mind boggles.
Like you said, technology in and of itself is not good or evil, but it's the way it's used, and I guess that's like many things in life. So voice banking, it might make someone think about, and it might really bring up feelings of their legacy and questioning their legacy. So, you know, if I've got my voice on a communication device, what happens when I die and the voice is still on the device? But once you've done your voice banking, it's yours, and it should be treated pretty much like any other asset, like a property or a resource, and you choose to do with it whatever you want. So it's important to think about what do you want to do with it. You might document that somewhere or tell someone important to you that you trust what you want to have done with it after you pass away, so that you can have your wishes respected and honored.
Yeah. Okay. Sarah, you're still early in your career. I mean, you just finished your PhD and you're still starting out. Where do you see yourself in a few years? Like, what direction are you going to go into? Do you think you're going to do more research or more practical work or both? Or what are your next goals?
Yeah, so my vision.
Yeah, if you have a vision, that's even better.
Yeah, I've really loved working clinically and doing my research, what I would like to call being a double agent, so being a clinician and a researcher. I think, you know, being a researcher helps ensure my clinical work is evidence-based and my research is clinically relevant. So I really enjoy dabbling in both simultaneously. But it definitely has its challenges. But I think where I would love to keep heading is to continue to balance those two things. So to continue to work with people, I love people, and to continue to do research and to, see where that takes me.
That's a great mixture. You have given me some beautiful insight into what you like about your practical work. We work with clients and also in particular with people living with MND, and about their courage and hope and so on. Can you speak to that a little?
Yeah. So I think I've had quite a journey in supporting people with MND over the years. I don't think we learned much about MND at uni, and I vaguely heard about MND on the news with the Ice Bucket Challenge and the famous physicist Stephen Hawking who died with MND. And all of a sudden, early in my career, I unexpectedly found myself in a role with a very large MND caseload. So I was very nervous because it was very unfamiliar. So I had to upskill very quickly to ensure I was providing my clients with quality care. And I did this in a few ways, including completing the MND Aware course. And that gave me a really great overview of the disease. And if you're interested in doing that course, it's available online via the MND New South Wales Association website. And this course was actually one of the first things that sparked my interest in MND. And I'm also really grateful to the speechies who mentored me and shared all their tips and tricks. But I would say my greatest teachers were the people with MND themselves and their families. I have been so blessed to be able to journey with. They've taught me so much about what it's like to live with the reality of facing your mortality. They've taught me about courage and bravery, about sacrifice and, you know, the power of loving your family. They've taught me about faith and living in hope and the power of perseverance. And I've learned so many tech hacks from my tech savvy clients, as well as really creative tips and tricks to manage different symptoms and so much more. So, thank you to the people with MND who continue to teach us and help us to develop as people and clinicians. I really value the therapeutic relationship you build when supporting people with MND and their families, and working in the community. We often get to do the whole journey with the person with MND and their close others, you know, from the time of diagnosis until they pass away, and sometimes even before the diagnosis. And I find that when you talk with people with MND about health and sickness and living and dying, they often open up and share so much about themselves, about their values, their wishes, their beliefs, their joys and their regrets, and so much more. So, I see it as an absolute privilege and honor to be able to listen to people's stories and to journey with them and support them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sarah, at the end of each podcast, I ask what is important for people to spend their time on, because this podcast is about the time we have, and you just summarized how it is enriched for you by the people you work with. So what is important for you to spend your time on? What are the important things in your life at the moment?
Yeah, so some important things to me in my life are my faith. So I'm a Christian and I spend quite a bit of time in my week doing related things. I also love spending time with my friends and my family, and we do all sorts of things together, whether it's playing board games or going for a hike or watching a movie, really anything. It's the company that counts. And I also love spending time doing all my different hobbies, whether it's being creative and doing some photography or being active and going for a bike ride. And one of my favorite things to do is to travel.
I do.
Yeah, I love traveling with my family and exploring new places and seeing beautiful nature around the world and meeting new people and learning about different cultures and history and tasting great food. Yeah, it always reminds me of how big and precious life is. And I obviously spend a big part of my weekday as being a speechy, and I'm so grateful that I enjoy the work that I do.
Yeah, sounds like you're full of beans and enjoy everything you do, which is fantastic. Thank you for spending this really afternoon with me, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Till later. Bye.
MND New South Wales is funded largely by the generosity of community members, with only around 10 to 15% being received from government funding. If you'd like to donate, please go to www.mndnsw.org.au/donate or give MND New South Wales a call and one of our friendly staff will assist you. Check out our website for more information at www.mndnsw.org.au or call the MND New South Wales info line on 1800 777 175.